Welcome to Sex with Simmery. Frank, occasionally explicit edutainment on the most important topic of all. Sex with Simmery is not intended for children and is not safe for work unless your boss is particularly awesome. See more at sexwithsimmery.com. Welcome to Sex with Simmery. This is Dr. Simmery, and I am very excited. Today's guest is not only a professional, but we actually have like a billion thousand people in common. And so we've been sitting here discussing like our multiple overlaps. We've never met before, but we have like this massive constellation. We'll definitely get to that in a moment. Super excited to introduce you, Alex Raboy, who is the founder of the Center of Growth and also Sex Therapy in Philadelphia. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. And yourself?
Crazy. I hate the winter. It makes me crazy. I'm losing my shit. I need your help. Cause you deal with all sorts of anxiety issues and stuff. Any immediate advice you can give me for surviving this?
Enjoy every minute of the craziness.
Yeah?
Absolutely. It's a beautiful evening out and life is busy, so you may as well get present and enjoy it while it's here.
All right. Okay. So that was like some instant recentering, like get my perspective on. I appreciate that. So one of the things we're talking about is the people that we have in common. So your background, where did you go to school? Where did you get trained for all of this excitement?
So I have a couple of different degrees. I have a social work degree from the University of Pennsylvania. I also have a postmaster's in marriage and family therapy from Council for Relationships. And I have a certificate of advanced studies from the School of Education at the University of Pennsylvania.
Cool. Yeah. So we have my graduate program used to be at Penn, which then transferred to Widener. So we know a lot of the same people, which is exciting. So shout out to all y'all who happen to be randomly listening. So what brought you into this field? Like, why is this important to you? Why is it fun for you? What does it mean to you?
So what brought me into this field is my love of talking about anything to do with sexuality. I feel like it's the one area that's completely untapped. The feminists and the liberals and the conservatives, nobody knows exactly what is considered politically correct or what's wrong. And there's a whole area to research. Mm-hmm. So it's really what people want to make of it. And everybody has something to say. And it's very core to each person.
Okay. So most people that come to you, are they coming for sexual issues?
So I would say in our practice, 50% of people are coming for sexual related issues, and the other 50% are really coming for more basic communication problems in relationships, depression, anxiety, trauma, anger, addiction.
Are those things generally interacting with each other, or are those like separate constellations of issues and you deal with them one at a time? Like, how does that normally manifest?
It varies from person to person. There are some people that are coming in very straightforward, which is, I'm in a relationship, I can't get it up, I really want to be more connected in my relationship, help me. That's very straightforward sexual issues. And then there are other people that are saying, I'm just fighting with my spouse all the time, and one issue just lends itself right into the next.
Do you think that the people who go seek help for these things, are they different than other people who don't seek help? Like, are they having problems at a greater rate, or are they seeking help because there's something fundamentally different about their approach or something?
Well, I would tell you that men are much more likely to seek help for sexual issues. So my practice is 50% male, and I think in most therapy practices, it's about 70 or 80% female. So in that regard, it's quite unique.
That's really interesting. What do you think accounts for that?
Men either want sex, or they think they should be wanting sex, and if they're not having it, then, or they don't want it, then they think there's something wrong with them.
So when most men come in for some sort of sexual issue, is that largely what's happening? They are either having some sort of sexual dysfunction or a libido issue. Is that,
or they think their wife is having a libido problem, or their girlfriend, or they're insecure about it, or they're very uncomfortable because they really don't have a high sex drive.
When someone presents with a sex drive issue, perhaps discordant between two partners, or somebody just feels like theirs is lower than they want it to be, or something like that. What's generally the course of treatment?
Well, let me just back up a little bit by saying the way I look at problems in therapy is not about a frequency issue. It's when you want something different than your partner. Mm. So if one person, I'd like to say the ideal is If you only want to have sex one time a month, match yourself with someone else that only wants sex one time a month, or be with someone who wants three times a day sex. If it's very different than your partner, then it's coming to a happy medium and figuring out what's happening, who can give on this issue.
So would your solution be, just generally speaking, if a couple presents with a highly discordant amount of desire, somebody that wants it three times a day, somebody that wants it once a month, are you more likely to try to change their behavior and to change their desire or suggest how they disentangle?
Well, I really want to find out what their initial contract was when they first got together. Was it that they both had a very similar sex drive and over time it started to diverge? In which case, there's a lot of questions that I need to ask to find out why did it start to diverge? Or from the get-go, was it very different and maybe they had the pact, which is you're going to be my white knight, you're going to save me, it doesn't matter if our sexual drive is very different. But usually they have some understanding of how they moved forward in the relationship from the beginning.
I have definitely noticed in speaking with other educators and therapists that it seems like the two jobs are sort of overlapping. That when someone comes in for therapy, they end up getting some really important education. And when people come in for education, they tend to identify areas that might benefit from therapy. So do you end up doing a fair amount of education in your work as well?
Yes.
Okay.
I think it looks a little bit different than when you're doing true sex education. In our case, we are educating people about the dynamic that's happening, the cycle, so that they can understand where they're getting stuck, what's causing the anxiety, what's causing the depression, what's causing the happiness, what's the interactional style. In terms of true sexual dysfunction, like you're not lubricating enough, then we're definitely going to do some basic education pieces or behavioral interventions. This is what you need to do to stimulate yourself, to lubricate yourself. And that's much more fact-based.
Okay. In terms of lubrication specifically, so when people present with that, like as an issue, does it tend to be more likely a physical thing, or is it like that the relationship has changed and they're not getting actually physically aroused? Like, what generally do you identify as being the core of that?
It's very much person specific. There are definitely people that are able to orgasm from simply thinking sexual thoughts. And then there are also people that can have the most traumatic, horrific sexual experience, such as rape, and their body is still having an orgasm, even though mentally they're incredibly uncomfortable and very unhappy. There's a physiological reaction that can be happening.
Okay. So you have multiple people in your practice. So do you have a specialization versus other people? Do you have different strong suits, different areas of interest, anything like that?
Absolutely. Everybody in my practice has a slightly different area of expertise. My expertise is that I tend to be very behavioral. So people that like step-by-step approaches to having ideas of what to do respond very well to me.
Okay. And then do you have like different areas where you're like, somebody comes into you, into your office, and they're like, here's my situation, here's, you know, what's going on with us. And you're like, I'm going to hand you off to somebody else in my office.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So what sort of stuff are you like, about?
So to poke a little bit of fun at myself, I always say people that are coming in with grief-related issues, those would be best suited with some of my colleagues who do a much better job of sitting with someone's emotions, which is a little bit ironic when you think about being a therapist, because clearly I have worked with many grief clients, but it's not the area that I gravitate the most to. I do much better with people coming in with addiction, people coming in with erectile dysfunction, people coming in with vaginismus, people that need much more behavioral guidance and appreciate much more feedback.
So speaking of vaginismus, that is an area that I think there are definitely going to be some people listening who aren't familiar with that. Can you explain vaginismus a little bit?
So in lay person's terms, I always think of it as pain in the vaginal area.
Okay.
So when your partner is trying to stimulate you, instead of sexual pleasure, it just feels a little bit painful and you're not necessarily lubricating as much and it's feeling tight and it's almost like feeling like sandpaper.
Ouch.
Yes. Not a pleasant sensation.
Like sandpaper. What's the course of treatment for that?
So an easy place to start is really finding out what turns on a person. What are they, you know, are they getting the proper stimulation? Are they sexually aroused by their partner? Are they able to masturbate themselves to orgasm? Are they aware of their body? Do they know how to lubricate? And those are the areas that I would be looking at. And if they're getting stuck following any of the behavioral exercises, then I'm going to move much more into a traditional psychodynamic approach. And I'm going to start asking questions about your childhood, the sexual values that you were raised with, the emotional blocks, about your early sexual experiences, to find out what else are you bringing to the table, what's stopping you, what's blocking your mind.
Okay. So I have a question just about, this is semi-tangential, but sort of related to talking about psychodynamic stuff and talking about childhood things. Now, I know that you're not psychoanalytic. I know that's not necessarily your background, but where do most therapists place Freud and his theories now? Like, where does he exist, like, conceptually? Like, does he still come up? Is anybody, like, how about you particularly?
So he's an amazing man. He certainly contributed to the field. And I think that we have built from some of the topics that he has raised about the unconscious mind and the ego and the id. And we have continued to elaborate on it and create more user-friendly terms and ideas.
Okay. All right. But, like, nobody's still talking about, like, penis envy, right? Like, are people still doing that? Are they still talking about, like, those sort of things? Like,
I think
Oedipal complex?
There are definitely some people, but that's probably not the vogue terminology anymore.
Okay.
I mean, I definitely think theories have changed over the years.
Okay. Because I always wonder, like, what in actual practice? Because I know that, like, psychoanalytic theory is still certainly in action. People are still certainly doing it. I'm just curious, like, what it looks like today. I didn't do clinical track, obviously. I don't know what's going on over there. One of the things that you mentioned before we started recording, actually, was that aside from the work you do in your practice, you also do some fun stuff with people who are coming from, like, a place of perhaps less dysfunction. Would you like to talk about that a little bit?
Absolutely. So one of the things I do on the side are bachelorette parties.
Ow!
Exactly. It's my most fun night of the week where there's a room full of women who are wanting to become the best lover and get the most out of sex. And so I come in there and right from the beginning, I have everybody filling out a nice index card with the one burning question that they personally have that they would like to have answered and the one question that they think the bride-to-be needs to have answered so that she knows exactly what to be doing on her wedding night.
All right. What got you into that?
It seemed like an unmet need that was out there. I think there's a lot of sex toy parties out there, but everybody's pushing sex toys. And to be honest, toys are wonderful, but it's not a core building block of your sexuality. I think toys are maybe 15% of sex. It's a nice add-on, but if you need to rely on the dildo, then there's a problem.
Okay. So what questions do people tend to ask? What are the most common ones?
Well, what's really fascinating to me is it's group to group. There tends to be themes. So we have some groups that are very much just questioning, what do I do when the man wants to have sex and I'm not in the mood? How do I handle that? Another common for a different subset of a group is, tell me about anal sex. I don't know what to do, or I've been trying it and it's not been working well. And the other is, I don't really like giving blowjobs. What should I do about that? Or how do I deep throat? Or what do I do that my guy really likes giving oral sex and he's really not that good at it and I don't know how to teach him?
Oh, that's a rough one. How do you ask a person who's not an educator, especially not a sex educator, because I think that that's, you know, that's a crucial piece because not everybody's comfortable talking about it. Like, how do you, as a random person, teach someone else how to give you pleasure in a way that is going to be not only, like, clear and, you know, they'll be able to actually understand, but also, like, in a way that, you know, isn't, like, a ding to anybody's ego?
That's a great question. So in long-term relationships, I have a cardinal rule, which is it's called use only positive sex talk. So it's not a normal discussion. Like if I'm fighting with you about the laundry, I might tell you, you know, it really hurts my feelings that you're not listening to me and you keep mixing the white wash with the dark wash and all my clothes are getting ruined. When it comes to talking about sexuality, all I can tell you is what I did like. So I'd simply leave it with, you know, it really touched me that you attempted to do the wash when I didn't even ask. So, because the theory is if you say something positive, you're going to build the other person's sexual self-esteem. The better they feel about themselves, the more likely they are to experiment and try something new. The more they experiment, the more likely they're going to stumble upon something that you actually do like, in which case you can come up with another positive. So the trick for you is to be creative in terms of how you're spinning what you really like so that you're staying true to form. And you're also giving them ideas embedded in it about what else they could be doing. So in the case of the laundry, I'd just be simply leaving it with, you know, I really like it that you took the initiative, because the story I'm trying to tell him is, I love it when you take the initiative. When you take the initiative, it makes me feel protected or safe, or it makes me feel like we're part of a team. So one day when he's actually in the mood to try to please me, he's going to realize, oh, she loves it when I take the initiative because it makes her feel like we're part of a team. And maybe he'll take the initiative and he'll shuffle the snow outside or move on with the next piece.
What if, let's say, I'm guessing this has happened to people where perhaps they had a previous partner who did a thing that they liked. How do you bring up, hey, maybe you should try the clockwise swirl or whatever, you know, something that like they may not come up with on their own. How do you suggest that sort of thing and be like, no, this is the way I like it without it being, I guess, too pushy or like, you know, I'm not sure.
So when you have particular likes, my rule of thumb is you can bring up a like once or twice a year and that's it.
Interesting.
And if you figure that you're married to someone over the course of 30 or 40 years, they're going to hear the same message over and over. And eventually, if they want to try it, they will. With that being said, there are many small details or finer areas in terms of communicating to your partner pleasure or displeasure. So if I'm on the receiving end, I become as theatrical as I possibly can so that I can give as much feedback to my partner. So I'm going to moan a little bit louder than normal to show pleasure. I'm going to use my body language. I'm going to use verbal cues. I'm going to be as responsive as possible. And when I don't like something, I'm going to be as flat as I possibly can be so that it's very crystal clear when my partner's moving in the right direction.
Okay. One fear I have with that is like, what about people who are just kind of quiet? Like, I mean, it's sort of,
you have to lose the quietness.
Okay.
If you ever try having sex with someone who's really quiet, it's a little boring.
Okay.
It's not so much fun. You don't know where they're at. And on the receiving end, there's a huge connection between use of vocal cords and accessing your inner power. Like if you notice singers, they stand when they're going to sing. They really want to use their core energy. And the more you sing it, it almost brings out another emotion. So if you imagine being completely silent and being sexually stimulated, it's going to take you longer to reach orgasm. Whereas if you allow yourself to get lost into the noise, your body's going to take over.
See, I feel that. But at the same time, like personally speaking, I've had some definite like, oh, we have to be quiet right now moments where it's like... partly the taboo of, you know, we have to be quiet, but, you
well,
know.
Those are different circumstances, which okay. Is it's certainly fun if you imagine hooking up and you have to be quiet because someone's nearby, and then it's implicit that you need to be quiet. But if you think about a long-term relationship over the course of 40 years, you most likely will have a lot of opportunity with nobody else around.
Okay, fair enough. So you were mentioning musculature, core power, that sort of thing. Can you talk a little bit about like what muscles people should be using, what this should feel like in terms of their physicality, what you would recommend?
Absolutely. It's one of the best questions that I get often. So from a female perspective, what you really want to think about is squeezing your inner thighs together, and you want to almost imagine your knees getting pulled in the opposite direction.
That's vivid.
Right. And what that position does is it will tighten the vaginal canal and almost pull up your pelvic floor. The other piece that you want to be doing, actually I think of it comes from Pilates, is you want to suck up your belly button to the back of your back and spit it out your mouth. And that's
evocative.
And that puts you into proper position. Have you ever heard of Kegels?
Oh, yeah.
I can imagine. So for anybody that doesn't know what a Kegel is, if you stop your urine mid-flow, however you do that, whatever muscles you use, those are your PC muscles, and that's essentially doing a Kegel. So I like to think of doing an advanced Kegel. So stop or squeeze your PC muscles. Imagine your pelvic floor being a circle. If I just squeeze it, I'm pulling everything into the center. Now what I want you to do is actually just focus on squeezing the right side of your pelvic floor or just squeezing your left side of the pelvic floor. Much like when you're doing your eyebrows and you're lifting them, you can lift them together or you can just lift one eyebrow or the other. The more control you have over your pelvic floor, the stronger those muscles are going to be and you will become more orgasmic. The equivalent for a male, just for any of those male viewers out there, is you want to try writing the alphabet using your penis. And if you can strengthen those muscles, again, you'll have much more control over orgasm and strength of an erection.
I think that's a really good point, because I think there's a lot of people who've gotten the idea that like pelvic floor work, all that sort of exercise is specifically for women, as though men don't also have musculature that they can strengthen.
Right. It goes both ways.
Yes. Yes. That's interesting. Why do you think that there is that sort of like narrative or that understanding out there, or misunderstanding, I should say?
I would say sex is something that is talked about, but not from a true clinical perspective. Everybody talks about sex in terms of the first time they hooked up with someone, who they kissed, but nobody's really talking about the details. No one's talking about the sexual dysfunction or the problems. Somehow we just expect to magically learn this stuff. And even in television shows, everybody's talking about sex, but it's really the idea of sex that they're talking about, not the nitty-gritties.
So this sort of also makes me curious, like you do bachelorette parties where you talk to presumably groups of women about, you know, improving their sexuality, making them better lovers. Are there therapists who are doing this sort of work with groups of men?
Not that I know of.
What's that about?
Well, if I'm going to go to a random group of people's houses, to be honest, I'm going to feel very comfortable going to a group of women. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that as a woman, I want to go to a random group of men and start talking about sex, because I have no idea if people have been drinking. I have no idea what context people are going to take it. And I don't have a buddy with me always.
Okay. Are there perhaps like male therapists who should be getting out there? This is the brilliant business idea.
I would say that men might have the same issue.
Interesting. Like a concern about like what large groups of men like will do.
I think it's real.
That's really interesting.
Which is very different than if they're coming to your office in a much more professional setting.
Okay. All right. I appreciate that you would come forthright about like a personal vulnerability sort of angle, you know, as opposed to like a conceptual like socialization blah, 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 sort of angle. I find that really interesting. When you are doing work with clients, and what are your favorite like outcomes that happen? What are your favorite topics to discuss with them? What brings joy to your day?
What brings joy to my day is having a client walk in the door and allow themselves to be vulnerable and let someone inside their world And that, to me, is the magic of therapy. And really, when someone's invested and they listen to what you're saying and they're willing to simply trust the idea that there is hope, and if they change their behavior, life can look different for them.
Who are the toughest clients to deal with?
I don't know. I think most clients are pretty amazing.
Are there any, like, you know, obstacles somebody might throw in their own path to having a better outcome, that, like, out of some sort of, like, habit or self-defeating behavior, something like that, that might get in the way?
Well, I think for clients who struggle making themselves vulnerable, I think it's very challenging, because you really have to be able to come in to an office and just say, this is who I am. And that can certainly take weeks for someone to finally get safe enough to show up emotionally. Mm-hmm. But here's the thing. Often therapists talk about sort of the client that's challenging to work with. But I like to say that if a client is challenging to work with, it's time to find a new therapist, because there's always the right therapist for the right client. Just like if you look at people that you would never imagine necessarily being happily ever after, they find their match.
Do you think there's a match for everybody?
Yes.
How does someone, for instance, who has a very particular, very specific, like, sexual interest, do you suggest that they go on, like, a FetLife and look for a partner based on that interest first? Or find a partner and then try to work on the sexual piece later?
So I always say finding your right match is a little bit of luck. And I think it really depends on how much you value any particular thing in your life. And that's what you need to lead with. For example, you know, if finances are incredibly important to you, probably you need to be dating a professional or a trust fund baby or someone that you have a good sense of makes a certain income level. If you don't care about finances, it's totally irrelevant. If you are very clear that you want to be with a partner that also has herpes, then maybe you want to lead with that type of disclosure. If you know that you want to be in a relationship and travel frequently overseas, that's a great topic to be discussing. Or if you want to have children. But what I find in relationships is there's no one exact package of what you're looking for. You just have a series of wish lists. And when you meet the right person, most people are fairly flexible.
Interesting. I want to go back to the dating with herpes piece, because I know that you have some upcoming support groups you're starting, and that is a relevant piece there. Could you speak to that a little bit?
So it's very exciting that we are starting another herpes support group geared for women age 18 to 39. It's for anyone that has been diagnosed with herpes, and it's to offer some support to each other, just in terms of how to navigate your own treatment, your own self-care, how to deal with the dating scene, how to be in relationships. It's a safe place for people to actually talk.
I think that's probably, like, enormously helpful, because, I mean, we're talking about, what is it estimated, like 1 in 3 sexually active adults, something of that nature?
Exactly. And it's one of those infections that are very highly stigmatized, and many people feel like damaged goods when they discover they have the diagnosis. And really, it's no more than having any other condition out there.
So how do you help someone who's been diagnosed, or, you know, has been living with it for a long time, perhaps has, you know, experienced significant stigma or people reacting badly to it? How do you help them reconceptualize themselves and their bodies, and, like, how to go out there and date?
So this is where a piece of it is the basic psychoeducational. Just what is herpes? How is it transmitted? How do you protect your partner? What does this really mean? And the other is to help put it into perspective. You know, many people have many different kinds of struggles. Maybe you have a mother who committed suicide, and that's a real trauma that you have to make sense of. Or maybe you've got breast cancer. Maybe you've got college debt or graduate student loans to pay off. that just because you value one thing doesn't mean the next person places the same values on it.
Yeah. So when someone is out dating and they have, herpes or another STI that's going to be there for the rest of their life, what do you recommend in terms of disclosure? When do you recommend bringing that up, and in what way?
So there's no one right place. I think people need to experiment with the different styles to find out what really works for them. One technique that many people use is to only disclose at the juncture that they're ready to become sexual with the other person. So it's a need to know basis.
So then when you actually bring up that conversation, I mean, is it better to do it in the light of day? Is it better to do it like...
It depends on you. Okay. I mean, some people, the way I like to think of it is some people prefer talking about sex at the kitchen table the next day. Other people really prefer talking about it in the heat of the moment. So it's really knowing what your personal style is. And then also recognizing that you've been living with this for quite a while and you've had time to adjust. Your partner may need some time too. And if you're not ready for a lot of mixed reactions, certainly disclosing right away is a great technique, because then it's very hard to personalize someone's acceptance or rejection, because it's not really about you at that juncture.
You have some other support groups you're starting as well, correct?
Absolutely. So we have an anxiety and depression support group going, and then we're going to be having a parenting support group. So we're very excited.
What is involved in the parenting support group? What sort of stuff do you talk about there?
So this is geared for people with children that are anywhere from teenagers all the way down to toddlers. And it's really giving parents permission to be parents and set boundaries with their children and learn specific techniques of how to manage children when they're acting out, what's normal behavior and what is really not normal behavior.
How do you deal with having so many other people's problems be your everyday? Like, people present to you the things that are causing them anxiety, the things that are weighing them down, that are hurting their relationships. How much of that do you take on? How do you do your own self-care?
Well, it's a great question. What I have found for myself is I don't like seeing more than 20 clients a week. If I see too many, I do take it on. So I combine that with doing a lot of writing. And then I also have a very full life. I'm a parent of 3 small children, so that takes up a lot of space. And then it's also having enough time to connect with my own peers.
That, like having your own life.
Having my own life. And sometimes going to work is the most therapeutic thing I can do for myself, because my kid can be yelling at me, for whatever reason, they didn't like the broccoli the way I cooked it that particular day. And I go to work and I think, oh my goodness, adult conversation. This is fabulous.
Nice. So where can people find out about all of this stuff, about your bachelorette parties, about your support groups, about therapy practice? Where can they go and find out more?
So I have 3 different websites. One is bachelorettespartiesinphiladelphia.com. One is sextherapyinphiladelphia.com. And the other is therapyinphiladelphia.com. There's a theme here.
You got in there early that you got all those URLs. That's impressive.
I did. And I'm actually in process right now of developing sextherapy.com.
You're going to get that one?
I own that one.
Oh my God.
Yes.
How long have you held on to that domain?
So I've had this domain for a couple of years. This has been my baby in the making. I have always imagined creating this amazing sex therapy directory that is worldwide for all therapists doing all kinds of sexuality-related work. But for me, it's been a matter of pacing myself, because, again, I've got 3 small children and a huge booming practice, and I can only do one thing at a time.
Wow. I am exhausted just listening to that. That is so much stuff. But also, no, just kudos on grabbing all those domain names. That's impressive.
Right. Well, I'd like to actually thank University of Pennsylvania for that, because way back when I started my graduate work, they said, you need to do a teaching practicum. And one of my best buddies said to me, hey, Alex, I've got a proposition for you. let's teach sex education on the internet. You do the sex piece and I'll do the business piece. And so back in 1996, I started developing an internet presence.
Wow. Well done.
Yeah.
I like these stories where it starts out with collaboration between people who've got different, like, backgrounds and skill sets, and then, like, merge it into a magical new entity.
Yes, I like it. I agree.
I mean, that's why I have a podcast, because Nathan's sitting over here. It was his idea. Everybody.
Excellent.
I didn't even know what a podcast was. I didn't even know. Awesome. So you have all these websites. I assume people like can tweet at you, email you, all that kind of stuff too. Like if somebody has any questions, that sort of stuff.
Absolutely. Just find me online.
Okay. All right. So what sort of takeaway would you like more than anything else for people that are listening today and they've heard about a whole bunch of different stuff? Just something that you think would be important for people to know, something that would be valuable for them to think about for the rest of the day.
Every day, I really want people to think about what's the one thing that they are enjoying about anyone that they're with, and can they tell them what they're appreciating? I don't think people hear enough positives in their life. And if you're thinking about wonderful sex techniques and ideas, only introduce one sex tip or new idea per week, and that way your partner will always think of you as the most creative, evolving sexual partner forevermore. Because if you introduce too many items at one time, they're going to be overwhelmed, they're going to have a great night, and then they're going to wonder, what are we doing tomorrow night?
Oh. So like, keep a journal, and then you can whip them out like once a week?
Absolutely. Or just, you know, listen to this podcast and pick up one new idea every time you hear it, and actually implement it, and then you'll be seen as the most creative sexual lover possible and get the most out of sex.
So you might throw some stuff out there and it doesn't stick too. I mean, that's always possible, right?
And if you just keep trying new ideas, you know, once or twice a year, eventually when your partner's ready and they're in the mood to please, they'll go for the idea.
All right. I like it. Thank you so much. This has been incredibly edifying and like a lot of different ways too as well. So I want to thank Alex Raboy, the founder of the Center for Growth and Sex Therapy in Philadelphia. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you everyone for listening. And you got all that information, all those different URLs where you can find out more. Thank you all for listening and have a good day. Thank you for listening to Sex with Timory. Sex with Timory, the podcast, is produced by Nathan Karuna. Our opening music is by Charles Evans. Our closing music is by Hanya Lee. Be sure to check out sexwithtimory.com, Sex with Timory on Facebook, and tweet at me, Timory_LEIGH. If you're a fan of the show, if you like it at all, a little bit maybe even, rate and review us on iTunes and tell your friends all about it. And thank you.